people can look at me doing something like this and say, that Brett's having a nice time.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you think that maybe the patent system has totally distorted our perspective on shaving?
If you're the devil, then consider me a Satanist.
That's very strange. That's very nice.
Yeah.
You can derive the right economic theory by just being against bullies.
I said, Mom, this Michael Jackson has leather pants, and he's kind of my hero, so...
You know what's strange about coal miners? I didn't understand this until I went to West Virginia. Have you ever been there? You want a Maserati? You want a hot body? You got to work, bitch.
Yeah. That song's getting mixed reviews, honestly.
Obama, the union, and
he's right about Obama. I mean, you know.
But anyway, my point is, you could be wearing a much better suit, make yourself look much better,
right?
Without the name brand, and
right.
No one's going to know, but they're going to know that you look good.
I think there's a certain inherent integrity to the double-breasted suit and the bow tie, and if I may say so. The detachable collar. But your beard looks beautiful, actually. And also, it's nice and beautifully brown and everything.
Thank you.
And it's shortly cropped and everything. It's lovely. Actually.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. This is going very well.
I'm quite advanced on this topic, right? I would not recommend this to noobs.
Have you seen my boys? Because they're looking so good. I love my little boys because they're looking so good. Don't mean to be a bother, but they're looking so good. And how could I decide? Because they're looking so good. You see my boys, cause they're looking so good. I love my little boys because they're looking so good. Don't mean to be a bother, but they're looking so good. And how could I decide? Because they're looking so good.
All right, everyone, we conclude our 2014 Liberty Forum discussion series with a show filled with superlatives. Numerous school sucks records, including most topics started during one discussion without any of them being concluded. It is Osborne's least sober appearance. He's not really even drunk, but he had a few drinks. It makes him a little chatty, and I thought it was wonderful. Also, most unscripted, for sure. In fact, Jeffrey Tucker says something at the very end, like, let's do it, as if he thinks the discussion is going to start at that point. But unfortunately, we were out of time and we already did the discussion, and it's what you heard. So I really, really enjoyed this. I was super energized after this. But I will say that if this is your first exposure to Jeffrey Tucker, might not be the best place to start. This man has given some very fantastic, well-organized lectures, and I might point you that way. That way you don't have to send me a message saying, Brett, this sounds like you recorded a conversation you overheard in a bar. But if you're like most people and you love Jeffrey Tucker, enjoy. Here it is.
Well, here's the problem. If something is fashionable, then that means it's about to become unfashionable.
Correct.
So if you wear something that's unfashionable, it's very likely it's going to about to become fashionable, actually. So I feel that way about the double-breasted suit.
Or in your case, you make it fashionable.
Well, that's right.
Everyone else wants to.
The point is to stay ahead of the curve.
Okay.
That's essentially the goal in life, you know. The future is uncertain, and we can make it for ourselves. And if we're always deferring to those things which the elites tell us to do, then we're ultimately going to be behind the curve. So this is why I wear double-breasted suits. Nobody else is.
I see.
So I'm
more about sticking with things that are, I guess, timeless. Is that the correct word?
Yeah, but I mean, there's like a certain sense in which the double-breasted suit has a timeless quality to it.
Yeah, no, I'm agreeing with you. But I'm walking around in a suit too, and there's not many people doing that here.
No, you look amazing.
But at least like it's a thing that people do, and they do see people doing it. Where the double breast, it's a little unusual.
It's pretty edgy and out there, right?
And you're doing bow tie.
But you know, I love film noir too. I like to watch 1940s film noir.
Oh, okay.
And if you look at them, you can follow the fashions that are there. And double-breasted is featured very prominently, actually.
Sure, absolutely.
So, yeah. And I like it. Just in general. Yeah, it's a little bit unfashionable. But listen, there was a time in which the bow tie was unfashionable, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So if you hang on to something long enough, eventually you get ahead of the curve. Mm-hmm. And then if you hang on to it too long, you're behind the curve. But I think there's a certain inherent integrity to the double-breasted suit and the bow tie. And, if I may say so, the detachable collar, which I think is an important...
We've talked about this before, you can't find it.
Wait a minute.
So, I mean, do you...
I'm in the dark. Detachable collar.
This is... Detachable collar.
Right. You unhook it, so you clean it separately.
I'm glad to do a presentation of this, but I have with me something like 17 collars.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Shirt collars.
Yeah. Shirt collars.
So you can press it separately and you do it properly.
And you attach them to
And not only that, but it's the quickest to get worn out and dirty. Right? So you can get a new one without having to replace
Before the military costume of World War II came into being, detachable collars were the universal... feature of men's wardrobes. And with World War II and the military costume, they wanted to save money, so they attached the collar to the shirt. And then, you know, out of World War II, suddenly all men's collars were attached to the shirt and not considered a separate piece article of clothing. So for me, it's a protest against Leviathan. Yeah. I never wear an attached collar to my shirt. we're desperate, right? We try to do what we can in defense of freedom, so this is one of the things I do.
I would say, with the mass-produced quality of shirts these days, I mean, as soon as your collar wears out, you're ready to throw that shirt away.
It's so
anyway.
True. Right.
So unless you're having your shirts custom made out of high-quality fabrics.
But who does that? It's a little ridiculous. I'm never really going for the custom shirt thing.
All right.
So this is what I wanted to ask you.
Okay.
You blew past the topic of shaving cream.
Right?
And I was curious to know what you had, because I've gone on quite a journey with regard to shaving cream over the past couple of years.
Where do you stand right now?
Where I stand right now is I order my shaving cream from Penhaligon's in Britain. And
it is just
wonderful stuff. Yeah. But the first thing I learned is you don't use that stuff that comes in the spray can that they sell at Walmart.
Under any circumstances,
that is just the worst.
No, what's been the consequences of that?
It's just awesome. The feel of it, the smell of it.
Why wouldn't you use anything that's like in one of those press button? It has to be soft. You have to be able to squeeze it out.
Yeah.
Like it can't shoot out.
Yeah, yeah, and that stuff is just horrible.
Like
for
whipped
your
cream.
Face.
No whip. If it works the same way as whipped cream,
right.
Stay away from it.
I mean, to my mind, I don't use any shaving cream at all. I use basically hot water. But I'm very hardcore on this question.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I used shaving cream for years, and my neck would break out. My skin was becoming sort of pulverized and tenderized, like a chicken beat with a hammer, and it was dreadful. So I changed my whole outlook on the world. Actually, it was very interesting. I was staying at somebody's house. His name was Jonathan Tomes. He's a DC editor. And he just said in passing, he said, "Oh, shaving cream? That's a racket."
Mm.
And, you know, somebody says something like that, you never forget it. And so 2 or 3 years later, I thought, wow, I remember Jonathan Tomes said shaving cream. That's a racket. And so then I started not using it anymore, and it was great. It took 2 or 3 days to adapt, but now I can just shave
And you know what's a bigger racket than the cream is the blades. Like, oh, we need to have 6 blades. No, we need to have 7 blades.
I know.
And like, all you're doing is tearing up your face more.
Have you discerned that maybe this might be a result of patent law? That the newest blade, here's my 5-blade Lyric razor, and now I have the Monopoly patent on it. I'm going to depreciate my 4-blade razor because that's now out of patent and anybody can make it. I mean, that's possible, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, how patents distort the productive process.
For sure.
Ways, yeah.
For sure. When the best thing you can do for your face is use the single blade safety razor like 2 cents for.
Oh, that that thing that's just a
blade. It's just a blade by itself.
And you put it in the thing.
Can you still get that equipment at
CVS? Is it still around?
Yes, you can buy blades.
Do you think that maybe the patent system has totally distorted our perspective on shaving? I mean,
probably.
I mean, there's a way in which patents kind of, you know, people say, "Oh, it's great." They incentivize innovation, but maybe it's the wrong kind of innovation. Maybe it's just like pointless change for no good reason.
Right, right. For to convince people not to use the
right, the thing that's already generic. Right.
So yeah. I still need to know, what do you use, though?
Well, so for me, but I mean, as again, I this is a long period of adaption. I'm quite advanced on this topic, right? I would not recommend this to noobs. But I use hot water.
No. As for the razor, because
the razor. No. So Jason and I think. I'm willing to acknowledge the fact that he might be right about this, but I'm generally, yeah, I tend to go for the latest, you know, three blade hoax, probably. Yeah, I go for the Mach 3 and that sort of thing. Okay. So I put hot water on, I take a shower, and use a Mach 3, you know.
Which softens the skin.
Yeah. And then I just take it and go, and just scrape it all off, and that's it. Yeah. That's the end. And so no breaking out, no skin irritation. Nothing.
So, now, you have a bit, I'm sorry, just one, okay, one more. One
okay,
more.
Yeah, okay.
You have a bit of stubble, right? You
yeah,
usually
no, no,
do.
No,
usually
do.
Keep a little stubble.
Right.
I have some too. I'm trying,
right.
It,
no,
I'm trying
cool.
It on.
No, it's cool. That's very nice. It looks very nice, I think.
Oh,
don't
thank you.
Think
that
so?
Seems yeah, to be no, the consensus.
It,
yeah.
No, it works well.
Thank
actually.
You.
No, I agree. Yeah.
So,
and you're sporting it in completely different ways. Like, you are looking kind of like a homeless. Whereas Tucker is looking
how am I
very
looking
sophisticated.
Like a
no, look,
but
I dress.
It works both
yeah,
ways.
For me, I dress so fussily in some way, you know, that I want to look more. You know, other things. You know, the thing is that you don't want a man who looks. You don't want a man who looks like overly fussy. Really.
Well, no, but see, this is my thing, right? This is a look that
cool.
I wear jeans that
very
are clean
cool.
and
right.
free of holes and stains.
Yeah, right.
I wear a sweater.
Right.
And I wear a collar shirt underneath it, and I pull this look off.
It
just
looks
fine.
Amazing.
Unless I have a tailor, right, who can fit suits to my body, I'd rather just not bother. I'm not going to JCPenney.
Yeah,
I'm not buying
I, know,
a rack.
I agree.
Right. You know, I have two or three nice suits. Didn't get to make it to the dry cleaners
right.
before. I think I made the same excuse last year
yes.
in this very same setting when I had my black Calvin Klein jacket on.
Whoa, so, yeah.
But I...
No, it's not necessary. I don't believe that all men have to somehow wear suits. I really don't. And in fact,
well, I just want to say, for the audio, yeah. I was called homeless just a minute ago. So for our audio listeners, there will be pictures, thanks to Carlos. But for our audio listeners,
no,
I do take care
beautiful.
Of the neck.
No, it's
I do take
but,
care of the
no,
neck.
No, but your beard looks beautiful, actually. I really, and also, it's nice and beautifully brown and everything.
Thank
and
you.
And it's shortly cropped and everything. It's lovely. Actually.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you. This is going very well.
Good looking,
go ahead.
Good looking men do not have to wear suits. But all of the rest of us,
you know,
in order to look good, you have to have
Jason,
a good suit.
I think you have hit on a very important insight here. One of the strange things about men is as they get older, they very mistakenly begin to dress down further and further. So if you go to Florida, your typical golf club, right, the men are walking around in these little white, squishy tennis shoes and sort of silly green pants that the wives have picked up for them and an absurd, you know, sort of plaid shirt or something like that, and a little hat, and they're doddering around. Meanwhile, their wives are looking fabulous, you know, with heels and all this kind of thing, and their husbands look ridiculous. So I would urge older men in particular to eschew this this culture in favor of dressing up. The older you get, the more you must dress up, actually.
Sure.
The more fabulous you must look. I once worked for a man. I think he was something like, worked for a men's store, and he was something like 80 years old. But he never failed to show up in the most wonderful, most fashionable suits there were at the time. And as a result, he looked amazing, you know? I mean, men need costumes, I would say, even more than women, actually. <Yeah. laughs> And why don't we know this? Why, as men, don't we know this? Why don't we understand this?
No, it is fun. I mean, nothing feels as good as like a really nice suit, you know?
Yeah, it's true.
But nothing feels worse than a suit that doesn't fit quite right, you know? Like,
oh,
you're
I
out
know.
There and you're like, I look like a real frumpy.
That's the worst thing. Even worse than dressing shittily, badly.
You can say shittily.
Okay, thank you. is a man who feels uncomfortable in his clothes. Because actually, on a man, the most important thing is to look comfortable and to look confident.
Right. So
right.
This is my theory, right?
That's it.
I've been dressing, I've been called, somebody said, I think they meant it as an insult, they said, you dress like a frat boy, right?
Uh-huh, and but that's where you feel good. Right?
But what I wear is nice enough, and I feel comfortable
right.
in what I wear. And right. I think that helps me, you know, carry myself better.
I think that's important. Better. No, that's it's hugely important. And it's a little perplexing to me because people read my articles, they read my stuff on dressing or whatever, and they adopt my theories on whatever, but they overly objectify them. So they get a suit from the store and walk around stiffly like a penguin, you know, always kind of readjusting their costume and looking a little bit stiff and robotic and whatever. And that looks worse than anything ever, actually. So it's way better for a man to stay in jeans and a cool sweater like you have than put himself into a suit and look awkward and uncomfortable. Actually, I mean, to wear here's what you should strive for. I think you should strive to wear a suit the same way you wear sweatpants or jeans or anything else.
Exactly. I mean,
it should be totally casual. Like, who cares? Who gives a shit? This is my suit, and I'm living in it, and this is my life. But unfortunately, men, especially with high detachable collars, are going to look rather uncomfortable. So you have to go the extra mile to feel comfortable and to live in it. You know, I would suggest that if you're going to go this route that I do, that you just put on the whole outfit early Saturday morning and like languish around the house the entire day, watching Netflix and surfing the web and, you know, taking a nap in the afternoon and everything. Learn to feel comfortable in your clothes. That's the most important thing. Confidence, comfortableness, that's huge. That's what a man should be all about. And here we are, guys, that we're all talking world here.
In my house, when I'm being comfortable, I walk around in my underwear. So are you suggesting then that I should come to Liberty Forum
in
my underwear? And that's how I will look the
Jason,
best.
Jason, I think you need to languish around in a three-piece suit. I think that's the most important thing you could possibly do. Sunday morning comes, you put on a three-piece suit, nobody sees it, but you just languish in the hammock and on the sofa and, you know.
Has anyone ever tried to make underwear as an outfit for men fashionable? I don't think so. I don't think this has even ever been tried.
Yeah, right.
The T-shirt.
Oh.
I believe that I was just upstairs and I saw a number of people walking around wearing underwear as outerwear.
Now, see, that's what do at Porkfest. Porkfest is a different kind of event.
You feel like this event is stuffy in some way?
I feel like this event is a little more...
A little buttoned up in some way?
Not too much, but like if somebody was wearing sweatpants, I would speak to them.
Uh-huh.
I've seen that here.
Okay.
So I'll introduce you.
But there are people who are planning, like today's Friday, right? Mm-hmm. And so tonight is going to be, am I right? It's going to be a big cocktail party and lots of people are planning their outfits and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So I've heard legends of outfits that people are going to wear tonight that I'm supposed to, you know, observe and that sort of thing. So in fact, I'm going to change my collar for tonight.
Oh. Where are you going? Somewhere else? Is it?
No, it's right here. But you can't wear a high collar before 5 p.m. So this is rather high. I want to wear a high open collar after 5 p.m. So I'm going to go up to my room and switch collars and strap on a new bow tie. The other thing is that here's what happens to you if you start wearing bow ties. Just a fair warning here. You get bored with the one you're wearing throughout the day. I mean, the one you're wearing in the morning, you don't really want to wear it in the afternoon. The one you're wearing in the afternoon, you don't really want to wear it in the evening, actually, it turns out. So you tend to want to change throughout the day. It's true. It's a true story.
I notice you're also wearing black before.
I don't. Yeah.
I'm wondering.
Listen,
about that.
I mean, are you seriously wondering about that?
Yeah.
I actually have went through something like an emotional upheaval about this issue.
Oh, did you? Okay, good.
Yeah. Okay.
I just got done chastising my father.
I've long thought of black as being the color for funeral homes and that sort of thing,
for
5 p.m. Waiters of after 5 p.m. for a black tie. But you know, after 3 or 4 years of seeing so many fashion designers put out beautiful black suits, I wondered if I was wrong, actually. And so I snagged this suit about a month ago, just based on the prospect that my theory had been incorrect. And so I'm trying it out. I'm trying it out. So, but it's working for me, actually, more or less, kind of, sort of. But we'll see in 5 years. Do you ever notice this, that sometimes you do things that seem right, and then 5 years later you look back and go, oh, God, that was just dreadful.
You should see what I used to wear in the 80s. Yeah, and purple and teal and
leather pants. I had to. I remember. I was nine. Michael Jackson. When I was nine, it was 1986. Right. So Thriller's been out a couple of years, but Michael Jackson's still a very big deal. Mm. And I said, Mom. Oh, sorry.
I've been saving that for you.
I said, Mom, this Michael Jackson has leather pants, and he's kind of my hero, so can we go and see if you can find a pair for me? So I did leather pants.
Oh, so this happens. This happens.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to dress like Michael Jackson, and I used to parade around my neighborhood with a glove on.
Oh, and time for my cool glove. Yeah, right.
Yeah. I used to attempt to practice breakdancing in my basement.
Oh, that's sweet. Yeah. But also, there was who's the other singer, White Wedding and all that kind of stuff?
Billy Idol.
He had the cool glove, too.
Yeah.
Was he before Michael Jackson, actually, with the cool glove?
It's hard to say what was before Michael Jackson, because Michael Jackson became famous right when he was like, he might have been before Michael Jackson with the white glove, but he wasn't before Michael Jackson. I'm guessing Billy Idol came on the scene like in the late 70s.
Is that right?
And Michael Jackson, late 60s.
Right. Oh, of course. But I don't think Michael Jackson had a cool glove until the 80s.
It wasn't until Thriller, I don't think.
Until Thriller,
maybe
right.
Off the Wall.
So it's possible that Billy Idol actually had the cool glove before Michael Jackson. Now, anyway, his glove was black.
Yeah.
Not white.
Right. And he did a kind of like a fist.
Yeah, no, he did the cool fist thing. Right. Right. We love that. Right. That was always amazing. Right.
Who else had a glove? Glenn Danzig.
Glenn Danzig.
Except he had a metal glove.
Oh, wow. That's really ramping it up, right? Yeah, yeah. Whatever happened to the gloves? So we don't do the gloves anymore? They become unfashionable? Or?
Well, that's interesting. The last thing you said before I hit record was, let's talk about pop culture. And it seems like that's great, right?
No, we can talk about.
Was there something specific?
No,
we are doing it.
I am
something specific?
So enraptured. I don't even want to give lectures anymore. Really, I want to encourage people to go see movies and television, that sort of thing, because all truth is found there. I'm watching the new second season of House of Cards. Okay, that tells you everything you need to know about government.
That's what
right?
I've been saying. I'm like,
I know
civics.
I know.
I never say required anything when it comes to education for kids.
I say,
should be required civics,
right? I mean, we spent centuries trying to come up with theories of how government is and correcting them and everything else, and then suddenly on Netflix comes this brilliant show that just reveals all truth. I mean, and what is that truth? I mean, the truth is the government is basically about itself. It's an internal system, power mongering and succession. And cruelty that essentially has nothing to do with the rest of the world, nothing to do with the rest of reality, really. And that's a beautiful thing that comes out of House of Cards. I mean, and that's just one example. I mean, I love that show. But another one is, did you see the second movie of the Hunger Games series?
I haven't yet.
Catching Fire.
Yeah.
Catching Fire is when everything really breaks, right? So the state system. Mm-hmm. Really begins to collapse, and she takes on catnip, whatever, discerns that the government has a flaw, and all you have to do is look for it. And she's counseled to this effect, right? Yeah. The system seems perfect. Everything's locked down. There's no escape. The powerful know all things. They've control all things. But and she's counseled. No, that's not true. Every system has a flaw. You just have to find it. And then she does. And it's just brilliant. Mm-hmm. Because I don't want to do a spoiler thing, but she smashes the system. And it's a beautiful moment because in many ways it's analogous to everything that's going on in the real world today. I mean, entrepreneurs are constantly smashing the system. That's what humanity does. We break free of the regimentation that the state has imposed on us every day in every way. We seek ways to be free. So this movie just illustrates this. And that's just one of many, many examples of what's going on in the pop culture today. I mean, all pop culture is essentially about liberation today, as far as I can tell.
Well, see, that's the thing, though, because and that's where I would object. Like, I would say that a movie like the second Hunger Games is more of an exception to the rule.
Really?
It seems like obviously we know that Hollywood has, to a certain extent, a political agenda that
affects
film and television.
But they have a profit agenda. They want people to go see their movies.
Well, that's part of it. But there's also a lot of political filmmaking, even if the subtext is subtle, but it's presenting ideas that are obviously more oriented towards the political left.
Mm.
And I mean,
that's true.
Somebody can make a complete Michael Moore, great example.
Oh, this stuff is
now,
tedious.
No, just use yeah. Michael Moore as a barometer
right.
for Hollywood, right? Because he makes a complete piece of shit documentary with hardly
right.
any facts. Everything is an appeal to emotion, an emotional attack on the audience, basically.
Right.
He makes a movie about capitalism, doesn't even define it. The movie is about something else, right? The movie
right.
is about corporatism and cronyism. He never
right.
even uses those words. So, and he's a hero. He's this great intellectual of Hollywood. So if he's any barometer for, I also talked to a television writer, a guy named David Angelo, who does a YouTube channel called E! Economics about being inside.
I like this channel.
You, all right, so David yeah. Angelo is a comedian.
Yeah, but he's marvelous, actually.
Yeah, he's great. And he's used to write for Fallon. And I
right.
said, so what's it
Did
like
he really?
Being... Mm-hmm. economically literate in Hollywood.
right.
Horrifying.
Yeah.
You know, it must be terrible.
But you know, here's the thing about this whole point about economic literacy.
Yeah.
I think I favor it, and it's good, and everyone should read Henry Hazlitt. But if you have an impulse in your heart that generally resents power, you will be generally right on economics too. You know, I mean, I think about the newest movie, the Lego Movie. Have you seen the Lego Movie?
I've seen it.
No, it's just you saw it twice. It's magnificent because you don't have a sense of really the creators of this movie really understood economics, but there's an ethos in the movie that is against control and against power and against gluing people down, against subverting the creative impulse within all of us, and this is the theme of the movie. You know, throughout from the beginning to the end, it's basically I would call it an anarchist film in every way. Even though there's no economic content necessarily, still you can derive the right economic theory by just being against bullies.
Yeah.
right?
yeah.
You know, and wouldn't you say, Jason,
I agree.
Yeah.
But it seems to me like both of you are right. Like,
yeah.
Brett, in that everything that comes out of Hollywood is leftist claptrap. But also, you are correct in that in order to market their films,
they have to do cool things.
The uprising culture, they have to kind of pay
lip service to be against power.
The notion of, you know, freedom and, you know.
No, I think it's true. I mean, and I was stunned. Why did you see it twice, by the way?
Two sets of kids.
Okay.
I took my kids and then I took my sister's kids.
Okay.
So I think that's an important.
So I go to these movies regardless of children. I love animated films. I find more truth in animated films than I find in so-called adult movies, which are actually rather tedious for the most part.
That's actually a good point.
Yeah.
You can when you start to take steps away from reality, like look at South Park. They can get away with almost anything. And I said, I remember I was a history teacher. It was like 2005. And I said, and we were talking about government and politics. And it was, it might have been 2004 because it was right after the election, the Bush-Kerry election.
Yeah.
And I said, you know what you kids should do? You should watch South Park. You'd learn more by watching that than watching
true?
Cable news. And I got spoken to by the people. So you shouldn't tell.
No, but I understand exactly what you mean. I mean,
you can move away from reality when you animate.
Yeah. And I was recently in Australia, and I was supposed to deliver a lecture on the state,
mm-hmm.
okay? And it was, I'd sort of done a lot of study, and I looked at 200 years of history of the theory of the state, and I was going to go through this long history or whatever. And suddenly it struck me as I, because I, and the night before I watched the second Hunger Games, Catching Fire. And I got up and I thought, you know, There's nothing I have to say that's going to improve on the message of this one movie, actually. So just go see the movie. But in case you're not going to see the movie, I'll give a lecture anyway.
Right.
I mean, I think that people can learn so much from the right popular media, you know?
Well, I think here's the thing, right? Because I think about this a lot with my show, yep. Right? Like, I want to be logical. I want to use reason. I don't want to. We talked about Michael Moore. I don't want to play tricks on people. Yeah. I don't want to say, oh, look at this sad man who helps me make my point. Well, you're in an emotionally weakened state, so I can drive home some shitty, shallow argument.
I know.
So how do we,
exactly? You perfectly summed up Michael Moore.
But how do we reach people? But how do we reach people? So I found that, like, last time you were on the show, we were talking about Scorsese. Right? Wolf of Wall Street.
Oh, that's right.
Does an awesome job just with music. Just the juxtapositions of, like, happy music to grim action activates people emotionally. And when you're presenting content like I do on my show or in video, yeah. I mean, I make a lot of videos too. You don't feel like you're cheating yeah. people, but you need to hit them on an emotional level.
I agree with that.
If you want them to learn and if you want them to change. So I think that obviously Hollywood or just the film industry, there's a lot of film industry outside of Hollywood, obviously, where yeah. a lot of interesting things are happening. And obviously, yeah. A lot of these guys started outside of Hollywood, too, including Scorsese. But that medium has all kinds of opportunities to really reach people on an emotional level without Michael.
Well, I think it's very important, actually, for those of us of the anarchist bent to get into media. And this is going on more and more. I mean, it's really cool to me how the libertarian world has sort of stormed the YouTube world, you know? I mean, 10 years ago, it was impossible for any libertarian to just immediately broadcast a lecture to the world.
Yeah,
and it's
yeah,
just
yeah.
amazing, actually.
So, yes, it's easier to produce the content and deliver it.
Right.
But then again, it's just as hard to get it into people's eyeballs
yeah.
because there's so much of it out there. You're competing in such a wide...
Well, the question is, what is the goal? I mean, are you trying to educate the masses, or are you trying to just inspire the few who can turn history to our advantage? I mean, to me, it's not about majorities.
You're right.
Yeah. I don't really care about that stuff. I mean, majorities implies a certain political template, you know, that somehow the goal is to elect the right people or storm the elections and get the right people in office. I don't really care about all that stuff. I mean, to me, the future is going to be determined by and written by entrepreneurs, innovators, people who are doing cool things. I mean, if you look at, like, Wikipedia, Twitter, things like Overstock.com, Amazon. I mean, you can go through a list of brilliant enterprises that have defined the world for the last 10 years. These things have had a much greater impact on our life than the whole of all politics combined.
I absolutely agree.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is the future. This is the way to change history through innovation and through doing surprising, shocking things that are implausible. Politics is locked down. It will never change. I mean, it's frozen. It's boring. It's tedious. We keep chasing it around for whatever reason. Probably the change is not going to come through politics, I don't believe. Anyway.
No, I think this also, there's a couple of good points here, and it actually, interestingly, it ties back to our previous conversation with fashion, right?
Yeah.
Because if you're trying to share with people uncomfortable new ideas that they want to run away from, you have to be able to present yourself as somebody who you have what they want.
Right.
Right? So if you walk around looking like you or this guy Osborne here.
Yeah, Osborne looks amazing.
What's that guy all about? These guys look great. Who are they? What are they, you know? But so if you, but if you walk around looking like you just fell out of a boxcar of a moving train and you say, listen, I've got some really great ideas for how you can change right. your political philosophy.
You know, I never...
But the media thing is yeah. the same way versus politics. Like being a creator versus being an assimilator.
That's it.
Because when you're doing, like when I'm doing School Sucks podcast,
right.
I feel good. I'm
right.
happy. I'm
right.
smiling.
Right.
It's funny.
Right.
Where everyone's, look at us. Look at us. We're having a great time, right? It's fun.
Exactly.
But if I was sitting in a school board meeting, I'm a victim. I'm pissed. I'm restless.
You said it.
So people can look at me doing something like this and say, that Brett's having a nice time.
Right.
Yeah. I want to.
That is affecting. That is catching. That's the stuff that's going to change the world.
Right.
By the way, I should tell you that I'm rather known for you know, the way I dress. Right. Mm-hmm. I never set out to do this. I mean, I only dress this way because it's what makes me feel most comfortable, actually. Mm-hmm. So I never set out to change anything as a result of, you know, the choices in fashion that I have. So
I started out dressing this way because of an article by a certain guest of the show. Yeah.
Wow. Whoa, look at us.
In fact, no, you know,
I told you this before.
I know that article is so dogmatic. I know.
My employee.
It's so dogmatic. It's so extreme.
It's dogmatic, but what it is it's efficient.
I know, it's very quick.
My employees.
Jason, do you know that article took me like 10 minutes to write?
Oh, yeah, of course.
And I think probably I wrote it after a bourbon early in the morning. Yeah. You know, I thought, well, I'm just going to write this thing.
It's very simple, right?
Yeah.
You need a gray suit.
Yeah.
Possibly a blue suit if you need more than one. And you need white shirts and blue shirts,
yeah,
and two pair of shoes, and you're good to go. And this is what I tell my people, because they all come in wearing, you know, Dockers and golf shirts.
Hey, tell me about your bracelets that you're wearing. You can't see them. They're very beautiful, actually.
Trafalgar.
Trafalgar. Yeah, everything about Trafalgar is amazing.
They make the best bracelets.
In fact, you know,
I can't even tell you another. There's one other one that I know of that I can't think of.
Trafalgar is amazing. Yeah, anything about Trafalgar. By the way, can I defend brand? Branding and fashion, actually.
Sure.
But there's a certain point to this, like Trafalgar, all right? But there have been a lot of studies that have shown that people who, like young people, irritate their parents by always wanting the brand name thing, right? They want the Izod shirt, or whatever, as versus the same shirt without the alligator on it, right? And it drives the parents crazy. This is the same thing. Well, there's been a lot of empirical research to show that actually these are not the same things, and that the high fashion item with the fashion designer name that costs a lot more actually advantages you in life. I mean, you could actually get further. You can get a job better. You can sell things better. It actually is an advantage, actually. So, I mean, in this case, the market is actually working. I'm just telling you the empirical research is true.
Right. So the first thing that comes to my mind that is a big thing right now is Tom Ford. You know, everybody wants a Tom Ford suit.
Oh, is that right? Why? I don't even know about this.
Tom Ford? Know
that? Yeah. No, I don't know about that.
Jay-Z is pushing this.
It's so annoying.
Oh, Jay-Z is pushing it.
And of course, because it's
so who sells it? Men's Warehouse or no?
No. I don't even know where you buy one. But
wow.
We're talking thousands of dollars, like $6,000 for a Tom Ford suit.
No, okay. Well, that was true. The suit that I jumped in the lake with, and when you mm-hmm. Did you see that video where I jumped in the lake? That was a custom $5,000-$6,000 suit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
It's crazy. I have a lot of nice suits. I don't think I paid more than $1,500 for one. I love the Vitella Barbaris. I can't see paying the money for the Zinnia.
There's Alan Flusser is the designer of the suit that I jumped in the lake with. Yeah, Alan Flusser.
Alan is the one that I learned everything I know about.
Oh, you read his book?
Yeah,
that's a brilliant book, isn't it? Oh my God, those books are so wonderful. Yeah, they're my Bibles of dressing. Actually, it's a little severe.
I have a copy of How to Dress Like a Man.
Yeah, of course, it's so great.
Sitting in the break room of my.
Yeah, office, so you know, he designed all the clothes for the movie Wall Street.
Yes.
Which actually, you know, this movie Wall Street, right?
Yeah.
You watched it. It continues to be. I mean, even now, even today, has resonance among the young generation.
It's fashion in Wall Street. The white collar on the blue shirt.
Exactly. You're so true. That is so true. No, I know. They weren't detachable, but they were still lovely. You know, when I think about Wolf of Wall Street, which we talked about last time we were on this podcast, I contrast it to the movie Wall Street, Wall Street was great because you liked Gordon Gekko. You wanted to sort of be like him. He was very cool. But Wolf of Wall Street didn't really have that. You know, there wasn't a hero at all. Although I'm told, actually, that high school students are watching Wolf of Wall Street and desperate to go into. I mean, it's had exactly the effect you might have dreaded the most. I mean, they love the lifestyle that is shown in Wolf of Wall Street. It's very funny to me in some way. I love the fact that Hollywood tried to create this movie that demonized capitalism and actually is having the reverse effect, of course.
It's hard to say what it tried to do.
It's true.
I think that was probably one of the appeals, like, oh, this will make these people look like absolute maniacs.
Right.
And it does have maybe a bit of a... It's not as strong of like an anti... But anti what? Like, I don't think Wall Street... We talked about this before, so we don't have to go too back into it again. But Wall Street isn't the free market. You know, all kinds of money is forced into Wall Street by state mechanisms. So, yeah, I don't know what it tried to do. I didn't think it was terribly successful. But the more I've thought about it, I was like, yeah, I should probably go back and see it again.
Did you watch the whole thing? Did you go through?
Absolutely.
Oh, you did? So I kind of regret... I mean, I feel a little bit embarrassed in a way that I after an hour, I couldn't handle it anymore. So I had to watch out. I had to walk out. Probably if I had been 20 years younger, I would have stuck with it, maybe. But for me, it was just like, oof, too much, too much. It's too much misogyny, too much violence, too much disparaging of capitalism. But, you know, the cool thing about our world is that your own views, like my views of this movie, don't necessarily prevail. I mean, you're 17 years old. You're going to watch this movie.
Yeah,
you could take away from it a message. I need to be a businessman. I need to do cool things. I need to make money. And that's not a bad message, actually. You know, in the scheme of things, it's not terrible.
No, yeah, you're right. Let's return to name brands.
Are you a little suspicious of my comments about name brands?
Yeah, you, Osborne first.
So
go
the
ahead.
Tom Ford thing. So everybody, so he uses not the best
I have
fabric,
to look this up, right?
But he's got a particular cut to his suits.
What, do they trim?
Yeah, I don't even know how to describe it. But once you saw one, you'd know another one if you saw
really?
One. Really? But they don't look great on everybody.
No, can't
you
possibly.
Have to kind of be a special shape person.
Sure. So what is the weave, do you know? 120, 130, 140?
Well, I don't know, but everybody... Every manufacturer calls their thing 120 or 130, and it means a completely different thing.
Oh, is that true?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. You know, yeah, okay.
Can't tell the difference. But anyway, my point is, you could be wearing a much better suit, and make yourself look much better,
right?
Without the name brand, and
right.
No one's going to know. But they're going to know that you look good, as opposed to the name brand, as opposed to some other kinds of products like your Adidas that has a name on it, right?
Right.
You know. So.
Well.
So I don't understand the name branding.
I don't entirely understand it. From my point of view, everyone should just be buying pirate products. Actually, I mean, it seems like a great thing to pay. You know, a fifth the cost of the real deal, right? I would love piracy, but I talked to a young woman who was a junior in high school the other day, who was carrying something like a Gucci bag, right?
Yeah.
I'm not sure it was Gucci, but and I said, why did you pay $500 for this? Of course, she didn't pay it; her parents did. I said, why don't you just get a pirate version? And she said, well, the problem is that, yes, for $15, I could get the same more or less bag.
Dang.
Right. But it might wear differently after 6 months. There might be certain threads that are a little bit, you know.
And you'll be outed.
Right. So, right. And that's the fear, that something would happen in the future that would reveal this. And she said, also, it gives me great confidence to have a real Gucci bag as versus a fake Gucci bag. Like, I can show it to anybody. Like, maybe there's some difference between the two that I don't entirely discern, but somebody else who's very critically minded might observe.
That's right. So troubling.
So the
that troubles you? No, stop it. So you look at your
so
face.
So the pirate market,
you're so maudlin about this.
Is excellent for gift giving.
Yeah.
Right? So
oh, there you go. So you believe it's real. Gucci bag.
Gucci bag.
You're right.
Then she will love it, pretend like it's a real Gucci bag, because she, or not even pretend, she will think it's a real Gucci bag, And then I'll pocket the money and be able to use it to, you know, go gambling in Vegas.
As long as you can psychologically, you know, protect people from the thing they think they own. But she was horrified about the, I mean, because from her point of view, her whole world would collapse if anybody just, you know, vaguely at some point discovered that she was wearing something fake.
So here's
you can't take that risk.
Here's my objection, okay? And it's a question of self-esteem. Yeah. How much of a person's identity is wrapped up in externalities? Now, look, I don't think I'm going to get you down, right? Because you are like dancing on the ceiling in here. You're like, look, guys, the world is great. The future is bright. Entrepreneurs are leading the way.
I understand.
And I'm like, yeah, but Jeffrey, the Bilderbergers and the Trilateral Commission, you got to worry. You got to see all this stuff. So... I know I'm not going to bring you down, but I don't want you to think I'm trying.
No, it's fine.
But there is a legitimate question.
Certain
of
superficiality,
right?
Yeah. A certain superficiality to all this, right?
Because people are saying, because it translates to this. Right. People, a lot of people walk around, they say, I'll be happy when, you know? Mm. I'll be happy when I have, or I'll be happy when I get, or when I do, or when I'm not.
It's sort of disgusting. You know? I agree with that. But on the other hand, markets work. And I've you know, markets can be slightly destabilizing and disorienting, actually. We look at them and we think, oh, for God's sake, why does Beyonce earn, $20 million dollars a year? I mean, this is just horrible. but I think I've learned over the years to look carefully at the market winners and say, why does this win? What cause does this serve? And I think if you look carefully enough, you eventually discover that there's a certain rationality to markets. Even though they sometimes offend our moral sensibilities, there's something to it. I mean, pop stars really are more or less brilliant, actually. And Beyonce is amazing. Justin Bieber is an extraordinary artist, actually.
Are they amazing or are their handlers amazing?
No, I don't think. No, they are amazing. And Jason, I would actually...
I'm sure... No, the ones you mentioned, they are amazing.
They are totally amazing.
But
I don't believe it. I used to believe this. I don't think so. The more I look at it, the more somebody like Lady Gaga is an extraordinary artist, an unbelievable hard worker. I mean, we can't even imagine what life would be like.
But you're picking the cream of the crop here. The Backstreet Boys. They pull together off the street and they kind of manufacture the story around
Backstreet
them.
Boys are like 20 years ago.
New Direction.
Thank you.
I only know because my sister
One Direction. Okay. These guys are totally hardworking. They have to get up early. They go to bed early.
You guys.
They don't drink. They live almost puritanical lifestyles. I mean, to go on a One Direction tour is the hardest work you will ever do. I mean, it's unbelievable. These people are incredible in some ways. They work harder than all of us combined, actually.
But why don't we say that? Why aren't we fascinated then by like coal miners? Right?
We should be.
They
work really hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love coal miners. You know what's strange about coal miners? I didn't understand this until I went to West Virginia. Have you ever been there?
That's where my family comes
from. I've been through there.
Your family,
I'm not from West Virginia, Jason? Nor have I ever been from West Virginia.
Okay, your family's from there. Hardly anybody actually goes there. Yeah. Yeah, nobody actually goes to West Virginia.
Like, for example, I have an uncle who still lives there, and you can't understand a damn word.
No, he goes like this.
Obama, the Union, and yeah.
Well, he's right about Obama. I mean, you know.
So West Virginia is a very strange place. But the thing that I found hanging out in West Virginia for all of 2 days is that there's certain pride that people feel in their coal mining history. And they love it. They love the art. They identify themselves with their position, their strata of society, and the contribution they've made to national life. I sort of love coal miners. And you're quite right that they should be celebrated as much as Lady Gaga, and they're not, you know. Mm-hmm. And you know, workers, you know, it's an amazing thing. I took a tour of a coal mine in West Virginia, and I was just enraptured about the role that the coal miners played in the structure of production in the late 19th century, especially, right? Because we saw this new thing called steel, which was incredible. I mean, steel instead of iron made possible things like bridges, right? And skyscrapers. I mean, steel was the birth of the modern world. And it only happened in like 1880 or something like that. You know, the point at which it became like mass produced and available for everybody. But the coal mining industry in West Virginia was like the in-between stage. You know, these were the workers that, and they did very well for themselves. At the in-between stage between, you know, the consumer demand, the extraction of the great resource that was shipped, you know, north and then put into the plants in Philadelphia and then turned into steel that made the great bridges and gave birth to the modern world. I mean, the workers in so many ways are the unheralded heroes of modernity.
Sure. Somewhere. Now, yeah. I know our friend, good friend Mark Edge just walked through the room. He hosts a show called Free Talk Live. They like to idolize truck drivers. For the same reason, in terms of
I see that Obama is attacking truck drivers again.
Did I not know this?
Yeah, two or three days ago, he wants to apply CAFE standards to trucks.
Oh, criminy!
Yeah, criminy, right? Yeah.
Really?
I mean, it's you know, of course, cars we know were destroyed as a result of CAFE, right? Mm. This is why our cars are relatively crappy compared to 30 years ago.
Can you just define that for people who might be unfamiliar with what that means?
Oh, CAFE is like, these are the restrictions on how much gasoline a car can use.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. And what it does is it makes cars ever lighter and ever less efficient.
Right. But what it also, as I understand these standards, it has to apply to a certain percentage of your fleet.
That's right.
So as I understand it, these manufacturers
for the most part, trucks are
producing throwaway cars
right.
to meet these standards. And they're literally just throwing them. They're like building the cars and throwing them into a trash compactor so that they can sell cars that people actually want.
Yeah, and cars are far worse now.
That's so Soviet. It's like a story from the Soviet Union.
It's so true, isn't it? I mean, that is exactly it. The whole car question is interesting because cars mostly look terrible now. Do you know that there's all kind of restrictions, not just on CAFE standards, which have changed the weights of cars and the way they function, but like the front hood of cars has to be a certain height now. You know, this is why cars look sort of terrible now as versus like 10 years ago. Because remember in the 70s, they would say the car of the future, and it was like this wedge shape. You know, remember that? Well, that wasn't the car of the future. Now the car of the future is like reverse. So it goes like this. So all the hoods are high. And this is because of government regulations that say, if you're driving a car, you're going to hit a pedestrian. You have to hit the pedestrian above his or her knees.
Oh, my goodness.
Did you know this?
No, I did not know.
This is why all cars, modern cars, new cars, look, you know, have this huge, huge...
No, that
bulging
that is,
front hoods.
Okay. Well, listen. I maybe they know what they're talking about more than I do. But if I'm a pedestrian, I want to be hit by a car that's wedge shaped, and I want it to. So this is what they honk. They're like, "Hey, I'm gonna hit you. Run up it, right? Like Mr. Magoo.
Right. What about the running up the hood point? Right.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought of that.
It's just a ramp. It's a ramp. You run or
here comes the car. Jump. Right. There you go.
And also ramps in the back so that you can just kind of like roll down the backside.
No,
I want it to be. It chose you know, like a bunch of beanbag chairs.
Yes, exactly.
You know, I was at a Publix parking lot the other day, and the guy had an incredibly cool car, and I said, "Where the hell did you get this amazing car? This is incredible." And he said, "Well, I built it myself."
Wow.
Yeah. So now we have online, you can go to these websites that allow you to buy a kit. Mm-hmm. So you get the engine of another car, and then you can build it yourself. And so you can make an actual cool-looking car now. But you have to buy it yourself and build it in your garage. I mean, this is horrible,
so
actually.
So we're using these words cool. And So tell me, what's your favorite car?
I look back at at the old ideals of the 1970s, where they had these futuristic models. And I was recently in Florida at a Bitcoin conference where, you know, you talk about Wolf of Wall Street, right? Mm-hmm. Go to a Bitcoin conference, you're going to see the Wolves of Wall Street. I mean, these people are amazing because most of the Bitcoiners bought in very early and they're doing very well for themselves. So a lot of them rented these Maseratis. Do you know about Maseratis?
Oh, yeah. Maseratis are beautiful.
I know they're what they look so like. Beautiful. But they're not allowed to be, of course, manufactured in the U.S.
They're not allowed what?
To be manufactured in the U.S.
They can be sold.
You can buy them here.
Well, you can import them. Somehow. I don't know how the owners of Maseratis get around the restrictions, actually. But they're so cool. They're so amazing. I mean, I'd love to look at them. And I think about Britney Spears' new song, of course. You got to work, bitch, right? You want a Maserati? You want a hot body? You got to work, bitch.
Yeah. That song is getting mixed reviews, honestly.
This is one of my favorite topics among
that song?
Yeah. Among the sorts of folks we're hanging out with today, because there's seems to be this culture around, we don't want to make money, or we don't want to make money because to make money you have to work for the man, or you have to, you know, bow down to the government, or I never understood that
within
mentality.
The libertarian world. You mean
the phrase I absolutely hate I can't afford that.
Yeah. Oh, really?
That irritates the living shit out of
really?
Me. Really? My response would. Or not my response, but instead of saying I can't afford that, is okay. Well, give me a minute so I can make enough money to afford that. Because you can always make more money. I mean, it's
really
people are out there wanting to give you their money for services.
Is that true? That's very interesting. But you speak like an entrepreneur, actually.
Yeah,
this is a capitalist thing, actually. Yeah, I agree. We do. I've started my own company, actually, within the last 6 months, you know, Liberty.me.
We need to talk about that.
Yeah.
I'm very intrigued.
Well, I saw a need earlier this spring. I was desperate to be able to publish without gatekeepers and to integrate that publishing with a social platform, with an archive discussion forum that would accumulate knowledge over time. And crowdsource the knowledge. And I wanted this platform, and it didn't exist. So I decided on my own that I should create it. So I doped out this website and attempted to sell it to investors. You know, and I failed and failed and failed and failed, and finally I succeeded.
I don't remember you talking to me about it.
Well, let's see. Now, last year was the last time we had talked at this time, right?
Okay.
So I didn't think it was on my mind.
No, it wasn't. Yeah.
Yeah. Come April.
I heard about it was a few months ago on the show when you were talking.
Yeah. Okay. So
come
April, May, I just had this itch. Does
and
this
I meant
happen
to,
call
to you? You and say, hey,
yeah, what the hell is this? Right. Yeah. Oh, you're so sweet. Yeah. Well, I shopped around the business plan all over the place. And, you know, the big problem in our world today is that history is moving so fast. Old people don't understand technology, and young people who do don't have money. So it was a problem for me, actually. As a seeking venture capitalist in this world, it's actually a little bit tricky. But I landed a good deal, and I bought about 6 months' time. And with this money, I have been working at a negative wage, by the way, for about the last 6 months, actually, losing money every day that goes by. That's what entrepreneurs do, contrary to Obama and his minimum wage policy. Yeah, right. That's what happens. But I've put together the website now, and I've got three teams of developers. We're about 2 weeks from release of the closed beta, and I'm just wild with excitement because I believe very much in technology and the digital world and the possibilities of for the future. You know, surprises by crowdsourcing information. And I think Liberty.me is going to do that. That's the idea.
I hope that's true. Now, from our conversation last time, where we spent about 40 minutes trying to extract from you the essence of this project.
And you still couldn't?
I'm still very confused about what it is. Like, for example, can you tell us how would School Sucks...
I'm such a bad salesman.
How could School Sucks Project use Well,
you get schoolsex.liberty.me.
Right.
And
what do we do with
from there you can post everything that you, all your content, and you can crowdsource from an SEO point of view.
Okay. But so we already post our content.
Yeah, I know, but you're isolated.
That's, you know, that is true.
Yes.
Because
that's my insight.
Ernie Hancock wanted me to do something something similar.
Right.
You know, with what is his site called? Freedom's Phoenix. Yeah.
Yeah, but that's old-fashioned.
Probably different in many ways from what you're talking about. Yeah, but Ernie's a helpful guy in that respect, and he's like, you know, bring your stuff here, and that benefits him.
Right,
it'll benefit you to have other people's content there, but it's mutual.
That's an important point.
Now, so the question would be: is there any kind of gatekeeping that goes on? Like, before the mics were rolling, okay, we were talking about some controversial subjects. Not like, oh, hey,
yeah,
I wish we could get more people
You've really tapped it. You've mentioned something very interesting. I've dealt with this variously over the last 6 months as I've thought about the content of Liberty.me. Because, I mean, I love freedom more than anything else. And I don't want reckless abandon. I want people to just say things I don't agree with, to do crazy stuff, to unleash hell on the world. And this is my heart.
Yeah, yeah.
On the other hand, I don't like hate.
Yeah.
So it's a problem. It's a slight issue. And
Did you say you hate hate?
I hate hate, yeah. I don't like hate. I don't like malice. And there are some malicious people out there, and I'm very aware that they're going to try to use Liberty.me to promote their stuff, and I'm very prepared. This is going to come probably April 1. I'm prepared to have to deal with this problem. So I know that it's out there.
Deal with it. You said that there was no gatekeepers.
Yeah, there's no gatekeepers. Yeah, I think we have to have terms of use. In the end, you know, I want ultimate freedom, but within a framework. You know, it's a little troubling for me because
So you've got dictators.
Can I give you an example?
No, yeah, go ahead.
Based on a conversation we talked about before.
Yeah.
Somebody comes to you, they say, Jeffrey, I love Liberty so much. Yeah. I'm very articulate. I can express all of these ideas. What I really focus on, though, is the Holocaust and how only. And, you know, it's not hateful. And then they're not even hateful about it. They're like, it was a terrible tragedy. The 1.2 million people who actually, I'm clearly making up some number. And for the listeners, this is purely hypothetical. Please save the ink in the letters,
okay,
in the paper. And they say, this is a really important idea that we need to get out there. It's something, I'm trying to think what's more controversial than Holocaust revision.
Nothing.
But, okay. So what do you do? And they're pro-liberty and they're not being hateful about it. But then the problem is, like I said to, somebody suggested a movie to me, just a story about this to give a little background. A couple years ago called, some Holocaust, one third of the Holocaust or something. And they're like, you'll see the truth. I was like, look, if somebody handed me a suitcase that said, here's all the paperwork on what really happened in the Holocaust, I would probably throw it in a lake, right? If somebody gave me like, here's all the UFO stuff about how the aliens work with the government and do experiments underground, in the lake it goes. Because
we pass it to our friend Carlos to release it.
Okay, yeah. Sure, maybe. But what I'm saying is, what we're doing is already, for most people,
outrageous.
Frightening and outrageous enough that there's an important question here when it comes to gatekeepers. Do we want to give people ammunition to use? Look what happened to Ron Paul. Some
I know.
Vagaries in a newsletter
right.
25 years ago.
Right.
And, you know,
it's still haunting him.
And
right.
It cost him a lot in public perception.
Yes, it did. It did. It was devastating. So I believe in the free flow of information very strongly. I don't want taboos in this world. I think everybody should be allowed to talk about whatever he or she believes in. Which is not to say that everything is true. It's just that in the toil and royal of the unfolding of history, in the process, I believe that truth eventually emerges, provided there's freedom. I strongly believe in this model. I believe in recklessness. I believe in danger. I believe in risk-taking, all these things. On the other hand, Liberty.me has to be valuable. And so if there's content that's being put out on the website that's dragging down the value of everyone else's content. That's a slight problem from a business point of view. So I think on those grounds alone, and hopefully not on pure ideological grounds, I might have to every once in a while intervene to shore up the culture of sincerity and truth.
So yeah. Still not being able to visualize this yeah. system that you're creating.
Yeah.
I'm guessing you have some kind of peer review system into it, right?
It's not quite peer review. It's karma. It's a karma system.
Gets in there saying things that other people in the community do not like.
Don't like. It's going to be voted down. But it will still be live.
And to have access to the community, you have to be a member of the community.
Yeah, you
correct?
Do. You do.
Or you can hit it off at the pass. This happened to me right after Sandy Hook, right, which was a school shooting.
Yeah.
So somebody was making memes, right? Now, I don't like this whole Facebook thing when, what do we call it? The victory lap, right? Some horrible tragedy happens, and people start doing victory laps, right? So people on the left are like, see what happens without gun control? I mean, it's a fucking gun-free zone.
Right.
They're like, see, if we didn't have guns, victory lap for the left, victory lap. But at the same time, a lot of libertarians on Facebook were saying, see what happens in gun-free zones, victory lap for libertarians.
Right.
And I'm like, hey, people, this is a major tragedy. As far as the official account, 20-something people died. Could we give it a week?
I agree with that.
So somebody starts making
memes. It's a
matter
of taste.
Yeah, somebody starts making memes and posting them on the School Sucks Facebook page. And I emailed them. I said, I don't want the name of my show associated with gloating over the murder of
kids. I agree with this. Right.
And the person said, I never thought of it that way before.
Oh, so that's good. You know, I agree with you. You know, I believe very much in reaching out to people personally.
Yeah.
I've learned this. Maybe you have too. In the history of Facebook, for example, I'll be on a thread and somebody will say something like incredibly horrible about me. Actually.
Really?
You know? Yeah. No, I mean, they'll say, ghastly things.
I'm sorry. You don't have to be like, the one who can give us a mic.
Oh, my God. The color of his...
No, it's not like that.
It was too short.
No, they'll say things like, I hate this man. He's actually the devil. You know, that happened to me the other day.
What provoked them?
I'm not entirely sure. I mean, what? Just something. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's liquor or something. I'm not entirely sure. I don't know. But what I always do in this case is I reach out to them individually. And I write them. I go, oh, my God, have I done something that offended you? Have I said something that rubbed you the wrong way? In which case, I would like to apologize. Mm-hmm. But I would like you to flesh out this comment a little more thoroughly to me. And they'll write me back. And I'm telling you, this almost always happens. They'll write back slightly mortified. Mm-hmm. And they'll say, I'm really sorry I said that. I didn't think of you as an actual human being. But it turns out you do have feelings. You do matter. And I just want to apologize to you for having said that. I was bothered by something you said. But can we talk about that? And I'll say, sure, let's talk about it.
Yes.
And it helps. I think human-to-human contact is the way to overcome conflict.
Well, at least in those venues, you have the opportunity to respond.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember, I used to get hate mail dropped off in my mailbox at my house. And in that case, you've got no opportunity.
Yeah, I know. No, it's wonderful to engage your enemies.
It's like, oh, my God, I would like to talk to this person, but I can't.
No, I mean, life is very interesting. I mean, we think we don't like people, and then you get together with them, and it turns out you kind of actually find a way to like them. And by the way, it's not as if... this is a one-time experience. This is an ongoing problem. We encounter people we think we don't like. We argue with them, and then we sleep a night, and we wake up the next day and decide, probably you and I are better off conversing with each other than arguing with each other viciously and insulting each other. Right. We can get along. I say that because that's actually happened. Yesterday and today.
That, I would.
Yeah, I know. Jason was my view. No, and I think nobody has access to the fullness of truth, and it's a good idea to engage people in thorough and rich and honest conversations insofar as possible. This, I think, is the great contribution that social media has made to the world. It's taught us that we can actually get along with each other. And that's a beautiful thing. But I think we have to sometimes take the initiative to make this happen.
That's an interesting perspective, because yeah. It seems to me exactly the opposite.
Oh, really? No, really?
This I don't poor see, man is going to walk out of here.
I don't see people getting along on Facebook. I see people...
I think that constantly. You can if you just reach out.
If you do what he said, you reach through.
Yeah, right?
you reach through the wall. Mm. Because this is the same thing. We could see this in real life. This is the example that I've used on the show a bunch of times. I used to drive 600 miles a week in Massachusetts. I don't recommend it, right? Massachusetts has a reputation, among other things, for having really bad, rude drivers.
That's Massachusetts as versus Texas, which has the world's most polite drivers.
Now, here's the thing, though. If you, the person who flipped you off and swore and honked at you, if you cut them off in the supermarket, they're, excuse me, I'm sorry. that barrier, right? The car, these metal barriers between people tend to bring out worse behavior. And the internet is like the ultimate barrier, right? So people can behave however they want and just get away with it. So when you talk about somebody calling you the devil,
right,
and they had no justification, I assume.
Well, I don't,
because I'd like to know. We've given you like almost 6 hours of airtime. Yeah, show.
I have
you
no.
Are the devil.
I mean, maybe I am. I don't know. I mean, nobody actually anointed me that. I have no sense of that. But right. Yeah.
If you're the devil, then consider me a Satanist.
That's very strange. That's very nice.
Yeah. No, I think it's the other thing to remember is that we all need to be checked. I mean, I sort of like it when people come after me in sort of vicious, wicked ways, because maybe I'm doing something, maybe I'm saying something that's outrageous. You know, maybe I'm I've followed a certain path of ideas that needs to be checked and pulled back slightly. You know, I think our critics can be good for us as intellectuals and thinkers and writers.
Well,
yeah.
How many times have people heard something outrageous and dismissed it, and then later on in their life?
Oh, it's so true,
say,
isn't it?
Oh my God,
yeah, it's so true.
I shouldn't have dismissed that.
Now we're here at the Liberty Forum. And we've met a lot of people, and we'll continue to meet a lot of diverse people in our world, you know, presumably all organized around the theme of human liberty, which does not say we all agree with each other, right?
Right, of course.
Yeah. So I think we can engage each other. Do you know F.A. Hayek had this view that somehow all of us lack the completeness of truth. We all walk around with limited knowledge. And I think this message is an important message, not just from the point of view of political economy, but from the point of view of individual behavior, really. I mean, we need to kind of recognize our own limits and see that even our most severe critics might actually have a point, actually, that we need to engage and correct. Which is not to say that in this process where any of us are going to become the complete human being with all possessing all truth. But it is that there's an ongoing process of self-correction, of play, of trial and error. In our own lives, we can replicate the dynamic of the market economy itself, if we're humble enough to do it and recognize that we don't know all things and that our most severe critics actually may have an important point, you know?
Yeah, it's a great sign when you find your critics, because it means you've gotten beyond the
wire. I know. It's a wonderful thing. I always think of my critics as my biggest benefactors, actually. For about 10 years, so in another area of my life, I write about music. Mm-hmm. And Gregorian chant. I mean, this is just a weird area of my life. Okay, so there was this guy who weirdly hated everything I wrote. And he would, like, troll me all the time. Like, no matter what forum I was on, whatever article I would write, this guy would reappear and like, attack me. And he had this uncanny way of getting under my skin. And so I would, like, respond to him in another big article. And I realized over the course of 10 years that a lot of my writings were actually in response to this guy who was, like, trolling me all the time. So at some point I realized, oh, my God, I would not have written, 150,000 words on the subject were it not for this guy who was hectoring me and trolling me all the time with his contrary views. So I sent him a Christmas present. I sent him a big book. It was a very expensive book, and I sent it to his house. I messaged him on Facebook, and I said, can I have your home address? And I sent him this book, and he wrote me back. He said, I don't understand this. I've been hectoring you for 10 years. I've been driving you crazy. I hate your guts, and yet you sent me a gift. What is this about? And I said to him, it's because I realized that you're my biggest benefactor, actually. You've inspired me. You've driven me to think new thoughts. You've asked fundamental questions about my core worldview that have inspired me to write passionately against you. And I look at the body of my work and I realize, oh my God, you are the source of so much of what I've done. So I wanted to thank him, and sadly, after my gift went to him, he stopped trolling me. Actually,
well, there went your muse. So we're having this issue right now. I was going to ask you, like, do you feel differently when the criticism comes from outside the choir?
Yeah.
As opposed to from within the choir.
Yeah, I think the choir itself is a little bit bored, and that's part of my hope with Liberty Me. I hope to give the choir something else to do besides just attack each other on theoretical grounds.
Okay. So you want them attacking you? The reason I ask is, yeah, like, I feel like when the attack comes from within, that hurts.
But yeah,
when it comes from without, it's like that feels.
Yeah, it depends, really. I don't like factionalism within libertarianism, and I'm tired of it, and I feel like we're getting beyond it. Actually, that sort of hatreds that defined the last 30 worlds, you know, 30 years. So I don't like factionalism. So I don't entirely mind factionalism or criticism from without too, but. Utterly uncomprehending criticism, I sometimes blow up, actually. So it all depends. I mean, like last night, I was visiting with somebody over cocktails, and I was probably inappropriately impatient with her, actually. And I said some insulting things, actually. This actually happened at this conference right now.
Really?
Happened.
I believe it.
Yeah, but here's the thing. 24 hours later, she came to me, and she said, "I just want to thank you for the drink last night and for the time you spent with me. It meant a lot to me, and I've really thought about what you said, and I appreciate you, and I appreciate the conversation we had." And I was really touched because I had been a little bit brutal in my conversational style with her, actually.
Oh,
and she
yeah.
came to me
oh,
tonight.
Everyone's talking about that conversation.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It was awful. Who else
no,
heard
I'm
it? No, okay. Yeah, I was awful. I exploded in ways that are uncharacteristic of me.
Oh,
so, yeah.
I'd like to see that.
I called her irrational.
Oh,
and
yeah.
No, it was horrible. But she came up to me tonight, this very evening, and apologized. Not quite apologized. She, in effect, apologized by...
Okay.
Yeah, and I... sort of apologize in reverse. And there's no reason in this world for people not to get along. I don't believe it, actually. I think we should all get along.
I'm the same way. It bothers the living shit out of me.
Yeah, it's because you're an entrepreneur. It's because you believe in commerce and you believe in the possibility of human cooperation. Mm-hmm. And we should get along even with people we radically disagree with. You know, in the end, I just presume that everyone at his or her core is an anarchist. You know,
yeah, that's well, that. Yeah, I feel like we're born anarchists.
We are,
and then it gets beaten out of.
I agree.
From public school, which
public
is why
school
we did this show.
I talked about this today in my speech.
But,
actually,
you know, priests and parents, and you know,
yeah, priests and parents. That's funny. You know, there is a weird moment that happens in our lives because we're born thinking that we're born, as you say, you know, this sort of free. We're born free, and at some point, when does it happen? 6 or 7 years old? 7, 8? We discover there's this thing called government, you know, which is external to us, over which we've never had any control. We didn't agree to it. It's just out there. It's just this horrible thing that exists. And our parents tell us about it. Oh, I'm so sorry to mention the fact that there's a president and we live in a country. that has a center, and that center presumes to control all of us, me, you, everyone. And it's a horrifying moment in some way. So we try to put the best gloss on it as possible. That's what public schools are about. They said, no, this is not a terrible thing, actually. This is a glorious thing because it makes you part of the great collective. You're part of the great American nation.
A collective that is already functioning when you arrive, right? Just fine.
Right.
If you are polite and you go with the flow, you will be invited to be a part of it. Lucky you.
Yeah.
And, you know, you talk about it being kind of like, over us, and we look up and we're like, oh, what is this? But I think through the school process, it's kind of being put into us.
It. Yeah. You know,
like very. Let's.
I don't want to offend your sensibility.
Yeah, I don't want to offend your sensibility.
It's so contrary. But I agree with you. It's totally contrary to human nature in some way to imagine this is an external thing that's far away.
Yeah.
You know, 6,000 miles away or whatever it is that's ruling us. And some guy that everybody elected is somehow the dictator over. It's not, I'm not a self-governor. I'm not just actually responsible to my parents and the tasks immediately at hand on my life, but rather there's this overweening power that dictates to me. And this is a horrible thing for a child to discover. Mm-hmm. It's child abuse. Government is inherently child abuse, I would say.
So we need to wrap because we've got...
I just wanted to tell Jeffrey. I've got a 7-year-old daughter.
Yep. Yeah, it was hard for you to explain government. Yeah,
son. And they don't like it when I leave the house. In fact, coming to Liberty Forum, not happiness
sure.
about it. But whenever I leave the house, or maybe not every time, but oftentimes when I leave the house, my daughter will look at me and say, are you doing something to stop the government?
That's
like, if I'm not spending time with them,
yeah,
that's what she wants me doing.
We were playing with toys one night. This was the
point. What happened?
It's his two kids. This was about a year ago, maybe a little less than a year ago. And I'm playing with their toys with them in the playroom at their house. And he and I are kind of having a conversation on the side while I'm engaged with the kids. And he says something and he goes, yeah, government. And then his two kids, who are probably 6 and 2, guys start going, ha ha, stupid government, stupid government, stupid government, ha ha ha.
Do you remember the first time, do you recall a moment when you actually revealed to your children the existence of the government?
No, I didn't.
Because they're not born with the knowledge, right?
At a very early age, had to explain to them, you know, why they need to wear their seat belt and things like that. I'm like, yeah, there's guys that will stop us from going where we're going.
You use the Santa Claus argument on seatbelts?
No, it's not Santa Claus. These are real life people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
It's a horrible thing, actually.
I think he does such a great job with his kids that
I'm very much a Mully and Nguyen.
Yeah.
I do not want to teach these
I agree with
conclusions.
I'm totally with you on this. And parents should not be ideological.
As much as I've tried to shield them away from
this. I know,
this
but
stuff,
they absorb it anyway.
They
get it
from somewhere.
I know. I get it.
But they get other stuff, too, that I don't know where it comes from. Like, my daughter is all about princesses. And, you know, I'm constantly telling her, you do not want to be a princess.
But it's so sweet. Ridiculous. I mean, that's part of mythology, and it's not really about ruling people. Princesses are about being beautiful and fabulous, and, you know.
I get it. We just went to Disney World.
Did you really?
Oh, my God, it was miserable.
Well, you hated it?
Well, because it's Florida, right?
Yeah.
And I'm not, that's not my climate. You're down in Auburn. I've been there for Mises Institute and many different events there. And it's hot, and I don't care for it, particularly in the summertime.
But your children loved it.
This Florida place.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. This was at the end of January, beginning of February. 85 degrees and 100% humidity.
Yeah.
How do people survive?
Yeah, right?
Like, I can't even imagine what that's
but
like.
But your children loved it, right?
They, So the daughter was all about, she wanted to meet every princess. She didn't care about rides.
She wanted to meet the princesses. What is her view on Frozen? Have you seen this?
She loves Frozen.
Have you seen Frozen?
No, I haven't got a chance to see
What?
No, they got taken two other times by different people.
Yeah, okay. Let me just tell you something.
I heard that's great.
Yeah, it's an amazing movie. That anthem, Let It Go, is the great anthem of our generation. Wholly libertarian.
I had to wait in line for 4 hours for her to visit the frozen princesses.
Oh my god. Yeah, I get that.
Obviously, I don't want to.
I was in love. I get Frozen. I've seen it like 3 times. I totally love this movie. And that anthem, Let It Go, Let It Go, Let It Go.
She plays it constantly.
Yeah, I know.
She gave her the CD for her birthday.
Yeah.
That's all she plays.
But isn't it not brilliant? It's so great.
It was great the first couple times I heard
it. No, but wait a minute. Jason, it's empowering. I mean, it's a theme of life.
I like the Brave song she listens to.
I see.
Which, something about...
But you don't like Let It Go?
In the Touch of the Sky, something like that. but she can listen to that. I'll listen to that many, many times.
But Let It Go doesn't do it for you.
Have you
listened to the lyrics, though? It's totally libertarian.
Oh, really. Okay.
You know, let the past go, and we're going to march onto a beautiful future.
Now that we're back to that topic.
Yeah.
So doesn't it seem like... So you mentioned that the truth is all in the animated films.
I think so.
And I think the reason for that is the truth hasn't been beaten out of them yet.
I think that's right.
So in order to market to what they're interested in.
You have to say what's actually right.
You have to give them the truth.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And it's only after you're our age.
I've found that animated films are reliably great. I've more and more. When they come out, I'm there for opening night. I love them. Yeah. Because they're for children.
So I'm guessing that it's because of just superior.
So that's so interesting.
Research, right?
Pre-public school.
And to your guys' points from before, it's permeating into the more adult films because people are growing up and not letting it go as quickly as they used.
We have to remember that government is the ultimate implausible institution. We should not tolerate it at all. In any respect, it's absurd to erect a gang of thugs that presumes that it's above the law. And that's the core of government. They impose on us laws that they themselves don't keep. It's contrary to human nature. It's contrary to human rationality. And ultimately, if we all thought clearly, we would all be anarchists. I mean, there's no other way. There's no other way to be. Yeah. Yeah, and this is why I love this podcast, because it taps into the core reason why we have failed as a people to adhere to our born anarchism, and instead adopted nationalistic, patriotic, sort of power deferential views. It's because of public schooling. That's the core evil. And that's why I love this podcast.
Well, thank you so much for an hour and a half of your time. And, you know, we didn't talk about school much.
Look, 3 hours.
I know. Look how great this show is. We don't have to tie it to some school subject. We can do anything.
Yeah, we can talk about anything. Right?
Yeah. So we do this thing. You remember after school specials?
Yeah, sure. I remember them, yeah.
And we started doing something called the After School Sucks Special, where we would just talk about whatever we wanted. And we would be these fantastic shows.
Yeah.
So
usually about food.
Yeah.
And the baser instincts.
Yeah, yeah. So I said to him before we started, we were kind of going down our list of people we were going to interview, and I said, what are we going to talk to Jeffrey Tucker about? And we both agreed, well, that doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. Let's just let it happen.
Oh, my God.
No, but here's the thing. Human liberty is the whole of life, you know. Yeah. So there's no reason to limit things. Really.
You're right.
You can just talk about anything.
You're right. Because I always felt like, okay, well, we got to tie it back to school.
No. All of life is human liberty.
We got Derek there waiting to come on next.
Waiting very patiently.
Yeah, so...
Speaking of us...
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry to take up so much of your time, but it's wonderful to be here with
great.
You.
Great. We wanted to put you last because we thought it could be an hour or it could be four. The previous conversations we had, which were both like kind of limited to time. Last conversation we had, we planned for an hour, The Wolf of Wall Street. We wound up doing two.
Oh, really? I don't remember that. Oh, my God.
And I split it into two shows.
This is the ultimate time suck, this podcast. I mean, this is just so engaging that it never stops.
I believe this is the most important podcast on the internet.
I think it may be right.
And not just because he lets me be on it. But.
It's up there. It's certainly up there. So, all right, Jeffrey Tucker, thank you so much.
It's wonderful to be here. It's so much fun.
Liberty.me.
Liberty.me.
Right, we will get our account.
Look, 2 weeks. 2 weeks from now, everything's going to culminate. And I spend several hours a day digging through this website. It's unbelievable. I think you're going to see things you've never seen before.
I hope so. So I love. There's nothing I love more than beta testing software.
Yeah.
So in my business, I'm. I have software.
I want severe criticism. I'm going
to
get it.
They can come to me to test their shit. And run. I call it the grandma test because my grandma is our accounts payable.
Okay.
And I know that if she can use it and make sense of it and not break it.
Ouch.
And I love giving things.
This is what I want. Test.
So I'm hoping that you'll let us test it out.
Let's do it. Right. It's going to be harrowing. It's scary. I'm throwing everything I know into this one project because I believe in the future and I believe in beautiful spaces.
I know we're wanting to end this out, but I want to keep going. And we were talking last night about because I still didn't understand after the last conversation we had who pays for this thing. Is it the content providers that are paying?
I wanted to do, I mean, everybody told me, don't do this. Don't do a subscription model. This is a disaster. But I kept thinking in my mind, no, my service, the service I'm imagining is so spectacular that I can persuade people to pay the equivalent of a one cocktail per month, you know. To have access
now,
to this.
Is this one New York cocktail or one West Virginia cocktail?
This is like a Negroni, okay? Right. Or this port you've been serving me tonight, right? So once a month.
Okay.
To throw in a cocktail, to have access to this publishing platform, this social network, to this archive, to this content delivery system, to the encrypted chat, to the news stream, everything. I believe in this. And I guess from my own point of view, I challenge myself. Like, if I can't do this, then there's something wrong. Mm-hmm. And I've been very pleased. We already have 2,000 members. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the tide has turned in a way. I think people understand the public part of the internet.
You say 2,000 members. So you've got an Indiegogo campaign or Kickstarter or something. So these people sign up for a year?
Yeah, more or less, 6 months to a year. So
you,
it depends on the package.
You've got yourself at least a year to.
Yeah. Make yeah, and yeah, exactly. And I have to provide value. That's the glorious thing. The upside I'm so excited about because I see things that are possible that don't yet exist.
I hope you're seeing it correctly because this is a thing that irritates me about the libertarian community.
Of course.
Kind of like the entrepreneurship that we were talking about earlier is the trading value for value.
Right.
And people seem to think that they should be able to just take what's laying on the ground and not be...
Yeah, I can't get this idea out of my head. I imagined a world that didn't exist basically in the spring of 2013, and I wanted to create this world. And this world is now being created right now, a year later, basically. I'm seeing it come to fruition. And I believe that people are going to value what we're doing enough to be able to pay for it. Yeah.
But on the flip side, though, as an economist, I know that the goal is to extract from every single person the maximum amount that they're willing to pay for a service, right? So when you set up a subscription model,
Yeah.
And it's like the same price for
everyone. I want to broaden the base more than extract revenue from the existing people. The nonprofit world that has dominated libertarianism for mm-hmm. 50 years has always been about extracting as much money as possible from the existing payers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe in that. I want to be as broad as possible.
Okay.
I want to change the world. I'm not interested in just sticking with the choir, as you say.
As we mentioned briefly yesterday, I feel that Bitcoin and the other alternatives to it
right.
that exist today really enable this ability to tap into the ability of people to contribute what they're willing to pay.
That's right.
For a product.
So like right a now, third of my
I listen to an album, mm-hmm. right? And they want $10. I don't want to pay $10. There's not any good way
right.
for me to consume the product and pay them the $5 that's
right.
actually worth to me.
Right.
So what I end up doing is I steal the album.
Of course. Right.
And that's horrible for everybody.
Yeah,
it's
that's
horrible
right.
for me, you know, because I kind of just feel shitty about it. And
right.
it's horrible for them because they don't get my $5. Right. Bitcoin enables us to say, I just watched this YouTube. That's worth 10 cents. Here's 10 cents.
Yeah.
You yeah. know, but and there's no other way of doing it.
Yeah.
And I feel like in a
right.
model like you're working with,
right.
Instead of saying, okay, everybody pays this much.
Right.
God, it would be great if everyone could pay.
We're gonna work in this direction, I feel like.
Okay.
That's a beautiful thing about a for-profit company, and you know this better than anybody else.
Do I?
Yes, you do, right, because you're a great entrepreneur, mm-hmm. right? And you understand that creating value creates wealth.
Yeah.
Right? So that's mm-hmm. what we're about.
Actually, you know, people who listen may realize this, and maybe you don't, but I actually make my money by securing government contracts. So it's kind of the opposite of
that. I didn't entirely understand that. I thought you were like a repo
no,
company.
No, we're a collection agency.
Okay.
So we have historically made our money by working within the market, but
well,
because the government has taken over our industry,
I see.
There's nothing we can do other
yeah.
than contract with the government
right.
to do what we do.
I get that.
Well, this is a trend too that, you know, you could have a conversation about getting on an airplane 12 years ago without it being a political conversation.
It's so true.
You could have
isn't
a conversation
it?
About debt collection or student loans.
Ouch.
At one time in history without it being a political conversation.
Yeah.
You could have a chat with somebody about going to your doctor.
Yeah.
You know, or your medical mm-hmm. needs or concerns generally without
yeah.
being a political conversation.
You're so right.
But as government yeah. goes like this,
you're right.
This is me,
everything,
those audio
yeah.
listeners, expanding endlessly,
yeah.
doing gestures that suggest that, more and more things become political conversations.
Mm-hmm.
And that's unfortunate that yeah. it basically took over his business.
Yeah.
Right.
So, I like people to know that, like, I make my money by working the system.
Yeah,
and I don't want.
So I'm hoping that Liberty Me is going to work outside the system to destroy the system, and also be profitable. So that's the goal. All right, let's do it.
I try to do the same thing, but granted, it's not for everybody. I'm not trying to reform public education.
Right.
Forget that. You know, I'm saying, hey, come outside, see what
yeah.
there is.
Yeah.
See where you can go from here.
Yeah.
Know? And attract the people that it's appealing to, and you know that's the best I can hope for.
Yeah.
So we're. I think we're pursuing similar things in some ways.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
Thank you. Again.
Thank you. I'm amazed.
Thank you so much.
No, it's wonderful.
Well,
it's great to be here.
We have to figure out when we can do this again.
Call me anytime. That's the answer to this. I mean, I love this show. I love what you do, and you're very competent and very insightful. So thank you for having me on the show.
Great. That's
glad to be back very soon.
We're going to use you as a reference now for the problems we're dealing with within the community.
All right, I'm going to cut it.